Thank you, Barbara, for inviting me. This is my first visit to the Fields Institute. It's an honor to give these lectures and a real pleasure to be here. So I'd like to say something about a mathematical theory of strange attractors. But if you prefer, as I do, to have a context to focus your thoughts on while I go over generalities, here's the context that I suggest. Okay. Think about a very simple dynamical system, like a limit cycle, like a stationary fixed point. Okay. Very simple, very tame. And now you drive it periodically, allowing it to relax for a long time in between. Okay. You drive, relax, like that. And I claim, and I'd like to convince you, that under suitable conditions, then with positive probability, strange attractors will appear. Okay. So this is a context in which the type of attractors I'm going to talk about will appear. Now, so the outline of the talk is like this. First, I have to tell you what I mean by strange attractors. Okay. And second, I have to tell you what type of strange attractors I'm going to talk about. I certainly don't have a theory for all strange attractors, only for strange attractors of a particular kind. Okay. And then after that, I'd like to show you how what a rigorous proof of the existence of strange attractors would look like or might look like. And then the last topic is I'd like to say something about where these attractors arise. I'm not so much interested in constructing attractors as in finding them as they occur naturally in systems, in real physical systems. So the first two parts of this talk is a general introduction. Part three is joint work with Don Wang, and part four, there's also some general stuff, but the part that involves myself is also joint with Don Wang and Kunning Liu. So this is the outline of the talk. So then I go on to the first topic, i.e., what do I mean by strange attractors? In dynamical systems, one could think about discrete time or continuous time. And for what I'm going to say, discrete time is the more natural, although the same type of phenomena happen in continuous time as well. So I'm going to give my talk in discrete time. So for the rest of my talk, then, I will be talking about the iterations of maps, which sometimes arise from flows. Okay. The X here is the phase space. F is a transformation of X to itself. I'm going to introduce the basic terminology that I use throughout, even though I know everyone is really familiar with it. So by an orbit, I mean you take a point in the phase space, and then you apply the map once, twice, and so on, and you trace out an orbit. So here's an impressionistic view of an attractor. There is a compact invariant set, this one, and that sucks in a whole neighborhood. If you are anywhere in the neighborhood of it, you approach the attractor in time. Okay? And the basin of attraction is the set of points that get attracted to the attractor. Okay, so all that is easy. Next comes the word that I will not be able to define, namely what's a strange attractor. Okay? Everyone knows, the term strange attractor has been used all over the place in popular science, literature, and magazines. And everybody means a different thing by it. There is no formal definition of a strange attractor, and I won't pretend that I will be able to give one. The fact is that different definitions are probably more suitable in different circumstances, so there is no point in really, you know, trying to be dogmatic about it. Okay. So, but I can tell you what strange attractors are not. Okay. So strange attractors, I wouldn't think of a fixed point, and I wouldn't think of an attractive fixed point. A single attractive fixed point is strange. It's not strange by any standard. I wouldn't think of a limit cycle as strange either. Okay? So it has to be a bit more complicated than that. Okay? So here are some of the characteristics that one often associates with strange attractors. These are not different. I will be a little bit more precise after this transparency to say what I mean by strange attractors in my theorems. This is just a general set of characteristics that I think most attractors share. First, you think of attractors as having very complicated geometric structures, and the word fractal dimension comes to mind. You think of strange attractors as having very complex orbit types. There are many, many different orbit types, So the words like complexity, entropy would come to mind. And statistically, you would think of observations generated by chaotic dynamical systems. For example, phi is something that you can measure. So the dynamical system may be somewhat complicated, but you're measuring one thing, say temperature or something like that, that you can measure. If you measure this at time zero, time one, time two, so every day, say 7 o'clock in the morning, you take your measurement, and you generate a series. This time series that you generate will resemble that generated from genuinely random stochastic processes if the system is chaotic. So these are some of the things that I have in mind when I think about strange attractors. Now, before I give you the list of properties that will appear in my theorems, I should say a few words about where I'm coming from. Since I'm going to be proving theorems, I have to work within this set, namely the set for which current techniques are accessible by current techniques. I also don't want to prove random statements about strange attractors, so I tend to focus on things that people and applications find more relevant, and the intersection fortunately is not empty, and I'm shooting for something in the intersection. Not to claim that what I have is really equal to it or anything, but that's what I'm aiming for. Okay. And the viewpoint that I'm going to take, at least where it concerns finite dimension, is that I think of positive Lebesgue measure sets as being equivalent to measurable, observable events. So this is when I go to infinite dimension, as I hope I will get to at least in one of the subsequent lectures, of course this notion will have to be modified. Okay, so I'm today most of the examples will be finite dimension, and I think of zero measure sets as things that can be ignored, and I can only see positive Lebesgue measure sets. So that's the viewpoint that I'm going to take, and this is pretty much what drives my choice of the properties in the next few transparencies. Okay, so what I'm going to give you is a list of properties that I think of as associated with strange attractors, but more than that, when I finish with this list, when I say the word strange attractors in the rest of the talk, it will be shorthand for all of these properties. Okay, so the first one is positive Lyapunov exponents, Lebesgue almost everywhere in the basin, or on a positive Lebesgue measure set in the basin. Okay, so let me first say what positive Lyapunov exponents are, or even though I think everyone knows that. Okay? So positive Lyapunov exponents means that if you look at a point in the phase space, look at a tangent vector, and the differential, the derivative in that direction is growing exponentially fast, lambda is what's called the Lyapunov exponent. So positive Lyapunov exponent means that this is growing, and that means that there's exponential separation of nearby orbits. Okay. Now, I emphasize that I mean when I want positive Lyapunov exponent to be Lebesgue almost everywhere in the basin. And not just on the attractor. The view being that if you really have a system that's volume decreasing, if you really have a real attractor, so volume decreases, the attractor is going to have measure zero. And you cannot see the attractor, therefore, because you cannot say exactly which point lies on the attractor. But the basin tends to be an open set, so it's a big set. And I want to say that in this big set, in an observable way, I see exponential divergence of nearby orbits. And something to be a little bit careful about is that I want to distinguish between a sustained observable kind of chaos versus what I'm going to call transient chaos. Now, in order to have a positive Lyapunov exponent, you must see some stretching in phase space. If you don't stretch in phase space, how is this vector going to grow? Okay. So phase space must stretch in order to have positive Lyapunov exponent. But just seeing a stretching of a phase space alone is not enough to guarantee a positive Lyapunov exponent. For example, if you look at this very famous picture of the horseshoe, Snell's horseshoe, this box stretches and doubles back. So there's a fair amount of stretching in this picture. But it's entirely possible that outside of this horseshoe, almost every point, that there is a sink someplace, and almost every point, in fact, goes to the sink. Okay. So I think of this as transient chaos, reason being that, well, there is an invariant set, namely the horseshoe. If you are really close to the horseshoe, you will stay around there and dance around the horseshoe a little bit, and it looks a little bit chaotic for a few times, okay? Sometimes a long time, depending on how close you are to the horseshoe. But then you get kicked away, and eventually you go into a sink. So if you numerically try to track an orbit, it may look chaotic for a little bit, but then it settles down somewhere. Okay. This is transient chaos, and it's not the kind of chaos that one expects to see in a strange attractor. In a strange attractor, I'm hoping to see positive Lyapunov exponent means that this growth goes on indefinitely. Okay. So it's a sustained kind of chaos that goes on forever, and it's observable because it goes on. It happens in a positive measure set. Okay. So this is property one, or requirement one, that I have for a strange attractor. So the second requirement that I want to have, or that I like my strange attractors to have, I should say, is the existence of a natural invariant measure. And here the issue is as follows. If you are in the context of a Hamiltonian system, then Liouville measure is obviously the natural measure. But since we are in the dissipative category, what's a natural invariant measure? A natural invariant measure would be one with the property that for almost every initial condition in the basin, think of this as in the basin, that if you look at the time averages, it goes to a number which goes to the space average with respect to a measure, mu. Okay, if such a measure exists, I would think of this measure as the natural invariant measure. Okay, so one way to describe another way to describe this measure mu, if it exists, is something like this. You pick a point at random, and you have the computer plot the first 10,000, 1,000,000 points. Let's say you plot 1,000,000 points in its orbit, okay, and you give mass 1,000,000, 1/1,000,000 to each one of those points, and think of that as a measure. That's mu. Okay. So I think of my strange attractors as having, it's good for a strange attractor to have this property. It's a good situation. And very, very roughly, the idea is that such mu's exist if the dynamical system is sufficiently chaotic. And here is a not so mathematical, more philosophical explanation for why that is true, is that if you think about a stochastic process. Think about a stochastic differential equation with an elliptic or hyperelliptic generator. There's a lot of smearing around. Wherever you start, there's a unique asymptotic distribution. Well, if the system is chaotic, it also there's a lot of smearing around, except that it's done deterministically, and you have the same effect. Okay. So when a system is chaotic enough, one hopes to have, or one hopes, expects, I don't know which one is the right word, to have what is called either a physical measure or an SRB measure, a Sinai-Weil-Bowen measure. These are two different things with different definitions, but for purposes of this talk, let me just confuse them. Okay, so I think of this maybe I should say a few words about SRB measures. So there is an invariant measure that we hope to have for dissipative systems. So just a few quick remarks about them. This measure was discovered by Sinai, Ruel, and Bowen for XMA attractors. Actually, Sinai first did it for Anosov maps and then generalized to XMA attractors by Ruel and Bowen in the 1970s. And then in the 1980s, the concept was extended to general dynamical systems. So you can talk about SRB measures, or this mysterious measure that we hope to have, outside of the XMA category, in a perfectly meaningful way, except that there were no examples. So for a while, it was a strange situation. There's an abstract concept that we could talk about, we could prove theorems about, but there were no examples outside of XMA. Until about the 1990s, when it was found for the first time, as far as I know, outside of the XMA category. And then, well, a lot of more progress has been made since. Now we know that many attractors have them, but still the whether or not an attractor has an SRB measure is something that's not so well understood. Okay. So that's the second property. The third property that I would like an attractor, a strange attractor, and by strange attractors to have is that there is some understanding of the number of ergodic SRB measures. See, the way I think of it is that SRB measures organize the phase space into distinct components, positive measure sets on which the statistics, the orbit statistics, are coherent. They are governed by the same invariant measure. So if you have if you tell me that you have an SRB measure and it's got 2 million ergodic components, it's good as having the whole phase space, you know, every bit of the phase space doing something completely different. Three components, that means that the room is divided into three parts, each one of which is organized by an invariant measure. So it's important to have some understanding of how many ergodic SRB measures there are. Hopefully not too many, sometimes one, but if it's not one, there isn't much you can do. Okay, so that's property three, and now I go to a couple more properties from a more observational point of view now. So you think of the dynamical system as a pretty complicated object, maybe very big, and you are going to measure some quantity which is directly observable. And then, as I said, you measure it day one, day two, day three, and so on, and you look at these observations. Okay. Now, if the dynamical system behaves like a genuinely random stochastic process, its fluctuations will be given by the central limit theorem. Okay. So one would expect something like this to with respect to SRB measures, what I have in mind, as converging to a normal distribution. One might also expect a rapid loss of memory, mixing, fast mixing. So I would say in a dynamical system, mu here is my natural invariant measure, i.e. SRB, as having exponential decay of correlations or polynomial decay of correlations, some fast decay of correlations, if you take any two variables, phi and psi, and look at the covariance of phi n days later, and psi, so phi and psi could be the same, that would be looking at your measurement at day zero and the measurement at day n. And the correlation or covariance goes down exponentially independent of those variables, at a rate independent of those variables. So that's it's like by day n you have pretty much forgotten where you were day one. Of course, that's not completely possible in a deterministic dynamical system. You could flow backwards, right? So this is only possible if you use observables that have some regularity. Okay, so these are the statistical properties that I like my attractors to have. And so let me mention a few facts that I think of as the interplay between the geometric and statistical properties. So what I tell you, it follows from general hyperbolic theory that once you have an SRB measure, you actually have a very, very rich geometry that comes for free. It has nothing to do with what I do. It just comes. It's a fact of non-general hyperbolic theory. Okay. Once you have an SRB measure with no zero Lyapunov exponents, you know that locally the structure is very rich, that roughly speaking it looks like some part of a manifold and a Cantor set, not necessarily always this way. Okay. Another something that also comes for free is the positivity of topological entropy. Okay. Topological entropy is a way of measuring the growth rate of the number of distinguishable orbits that are n long. So it has a large number of different distinct orbits. Distinct orbits that are n long grow exponentially with n, or the number of periodic orbits. It has lots and lots of periodic points. All these things come for free once you have an SRB measure with no zero Lyapunov exponents. You will know that the number of periodic points of period less than or equal to n grows exponentially in n, so lots of periodic orbits around. Okay. And of course, you have topological transitivity and ergodic components and so on, so different regions will get mixed up. Okay. These are things that really come for free from general hyperbolic theory. At the same time, to prove the existence of SRB measures, you have to control the geometry. So you control the geometry to prove that you have this measure. Once you prove that you have this measure, it gives you a whole lot of other things about the geometry. Okay. So that's all that I will say about the attractors that are properties of attractors. I've tried to paint a kind of picture for you about what these attractors would look like that I'm going to be talking about. Okay. So what I'm now going to specialize to a type of attractors. This type of attractors is what I'm going to refer to as having rank one. By that I mean they have one unstable direction and n minus one stable directions in an n-dimensional phase space. Or if it's an infinite dimension, then all but one of the directions is stable and strongly contractive in n minus one directions. So why rank one attractors? Because they are the simplest. They are the strange attractors of the simplest kind. Okay? If there was no unstable direction, wouldn't be strange. So to qualify as being strange, you gotta have at least one unstable direction. These are the simplest guys that there are. But as you have heard, there is no such thing as a simple strange attractor. So that's it's the simplest of what cannot be so simple. Okay. So what I would like to do is not so much to develop the kind of abstract theory, but to develop some kind of checkable conditions, checkable to the degree that is doable in mathematics. Okay. So that if you check that there's some list of conditions, if they hold, then I want to be able to conclude that the presence of strange attractors, and when I say the word strange attractors from now on, I mean with all the properties that I just told you of. Okay. So I'm hoping to find some conditions that would imply that these attractors with this entire package are present. Okay. And here's the strategy. Okay. The strategy is to embed so you have some kind of dynamical systems. You hope that they have strange attractors, and the idea is to embed them in a bigger family with two parameters. Well, one is a real parameter. A is a real parameter. It moves points in the roughly unstable direction. So I should say that ahead of time you kind of have some idea roughly what's unstable, but you don't know exactly where it's unstable, of course. Okay. So one of the parameters, I have to be able to move things in the unstable direction. Why only move things in the unstable direction? Well, it doesn't do much for you to move things in the stable direction, because you move it and immediately it comes back down again. It's a fast contraction. So that's what one of the parameters does. The other one is really not a parameter. I'm not going to be varying it. It's really a measure of how strong the contraction is. Okay. So B equal to zero corresponds to infinite contraction. Just contracts straight down to singular. Okay. So what I'm going to do is to the main condition. So the idea is to take a dynamical system and put it into the framework where you have these two parameters, and then take B to zero. Okay. And as you take B to zero, the dimension of the object drops because it contracts infinitely. So it goes down to a one-dimensional object. And one-dimensional objects are a little bit easier to handle than higher dimensional objects. So the conditions that I will be looking at this simpler object, this singular limit, and try to check a few conditions about them. All the conditions, or most of the conditions, are really on this simpler object, on this one-dimensional object. And if these conditions are satisfied, and then you will back up and conclude that before you reach the singular limit, you have strange attractors of the kind that I want. So that's sort of the thing. So you start with something and embed it, which doesn't necessarily come with these two parameters. You try to find a way to embed it into a family like that, go to a similar, a singular limit, check some things, and back up. Okay. So I'm going to get more into these things in the next two lectures, but I'm going to just flash the conditions by you so that you know what kind of what they look like. It's not important that you remember exactly what they are, and I'm not going to use them. Okay. So the first one is the fact that you can put it into such a family at all. That's what it means. Okay. So here x is one dimension, y with a bar there denotes something in n minus one dimension. Okay. So at least locally, and I've assumed here globally, that you can write the map, this FAB, as something. This is the main component. This is the main thing, main piece of the map. Plus b times something, b times something. Okay. Never mind what u and v are. It's not important. It has to be an embedding. But other than that, I don't really care what they are. I really could have written big O of b, big O of b. Okay. And b is the amount of contraction. Okay. So there's really only one piece that counts, and this is the rank one, right? This is the one that counts. Okay. So, and sometimes this condition is also useful for some of the results, although it's not needed for others. If you want some regularity on the determinant as well. Okay. So everything inside has to be U and V, as well as this F, everything inside has to be bounded to C3. Okay. And so by singular limit, I would take this B to 0. When I take B to 0, then it becomes just this piece, plus 0, 0. Okay. It becomes a very degenerate map from n dimension to one dimension. Okay. And so these are what I call my singular limit maps. Okay. And the rest of the conditions are on the singular limit maps. Okay. So the singular limit maps come in two levels. One is that you can first think about it as an n-dimension to one-dimension map. Okay. You can also restrict this singular limit map to the one-dimensional set, which is the image, and then you get a one-dimension to a one-dimension map. So now you get a map from a circle to itself, or a map of an interval to itself, and so on. So the second condition is to check that this one-dimensional map is sufficiently expanding. And for those of you who know what Misarevich points are, if it's a Misarevich point, it would be good enough. But in general, if you are, if I'm going to show that there is a lot of positive Lyapunov exponents, there's expansion in my attractors, it's got to come from somewhere, right? Okay. This is where it comes from. You check this one-dimensional object, it's easier to look at the derivative of one-dimensional maps, and you want it to have some expansion. Okay. So it's a perturbative result, so you find a parameter where the one-dimensional map is expanding, have some expanding properties. It can also have some contracting properties, but it's overall expanding. Okay. The third condition is about the parameters. So now, not only am I talking about the one-dimensional maps, which are in the singular limit, I'm only talking about what happens at that one point from which I'm going to perturb. So I'm really looking at just one map. That I'm hoping for something that I can check. So this is like checking something for a single map. And don't worry too much about what I wrote there. What it really says is that, well, there's a parameter, that means that there's a knob you can turn, right? As you turn a knob, you want to be able to effectively change the dynamics. Okay? You want to be able to change it in an effective way. And it turns out that a very easy way to express that, it's a very simple way to express that, is like that. So suppose your critical point, one-dimensional map has a critical point, and suppose it falls onto a periodic point. So now, when you move the parameter, you continue to recognize what's a critical point, and you continue to recognize what's a periodic point. They got to move at different speeds. Okay. They almost never move at the same speed, so it's a transversality condition. Okay. And the last condition that I wanted to show you is that, again, this only has to do with the singular limit map, and only at that parameter. Well, you look at a critical point. A critical point means that if you differentiate in x, in the first direction, it's 0. Then I want to say that there's some direction of y when it's not 0. Okay, not a big deal. Otherwise, this differential is 0 in all directions, and that's very degenerate. Okay, so this is the type of conditions that I want to show you. Okay. It's not a specific formula. It's not like something very special that you have to Okay. So now I didn't really list all the conditions, but it's mostly these four. So here's the result. It's joint work with Don Wang at the University of Arizona. Two-dimensional version has been published. Things have changed a little bit since I wrote this transparency. That this is actually two papers. One is going to appear in Annals, maybe 2007 or something like that, and and a second one is still in preparation. Okay. So it says that if you take a family satisfying the four conditions that I showed you, the four conditions that I showed you are pretty much exactly as I said. Okay, then the following holds for small b. Okay, that there is a positive measure set of a's. There's a positive measure for each B. There's a positive measure set of B of A's with the property that FAB has an attractor with all the properties that I mentioned earlier. Okay. So, I didn't tell you what C5 is. One could add more conditions and get stronger results. I should have said that I cheated a little bit. When I said that it has all the properties, it may have more than one ergodic component. Okay. What C5 will guarantee you is that there's only one ergodic component and that is mixing and so on. Okay. So that's roughly, and C5 is a mixing condition. Okay. So that's the theorem that I would use to rigorously prove the existence of attractors of this kind. So a few comments on this result. So this is contained in three different papers. Okay. There are some precursors to this work. The first one is the anal map. It's the one that's immediately before this. And a lot of the local analysis is, in fact, borrowed from the analysis of anal maps, and where Benedict and Carlson analyzed the perturbation from A star equals 2, from this one single parameter with the full parabola. Okay. There are some other results that are built on Benedict and Carlson's work for the Hino maps. So what's different here is that the Benedict and Carlson's work is to a large degree based on formulas. It's based on the specific form of the Hino maps. From time to time, there are some local analysis that would not require the form of the map, and then from time to time you would go into a situation where you actually need to use the form of the map. And the paper is 100 pages, and it doesn't prove these. It doesn't give the properties. Something a little bit before you could deduce these properties. So we felt that if every time I have a dynamical system, I have to run 100 pages before I start to prove these properties, it would be a lot of work. So we wanted to abstract some general conditions. Okay, that once you that's geometric, and if you not formula dependent, so that if you check these conditions, you would get the whole package right away. So that was our motivation for doing this work. So what do these conditions say? I want to say a little bit about what these conditions are, what this theorem actually says, because it's not so obvious if you look at it what it says. Okay, what it really says is the following. If you have a situation which is geometrically compatible with having a strange attractor, with having a rank 1 attractor, okay, then typically you have it. Okay. So what is a situation that's compatible with having a rank 1 attractor? Well, it's got to have an attractor. Okay. So it's got to come in and have an attractor. If it doesn't have an attractor to start with, you're not going to find one, right? There's no magic in this. It's going to be rank 1. The attractor is rank 1. So you've got to see some stretching. You've got to see some contractions with your eyes to start with. Okay. So you're already in the right condition, right setup, before you can start to check C1. C2. Okay. Now, what this theorem says is that if you're in a situation that's geometrically compatible with having one such object, then typically you have it. Typically means the transversality condition, the non-degeneracy type of condition. And when you have it, you don't have it for every parameter, you only have it for a positive measure set of parameters. Okay. So that's kind of what it says. If it looks like it's there, then if you're not unlucky, you have it with positive probability. Okay. And so I want to comment on why all this fancy footwork. You know, if you give me an attractor, why don't I just determine for you whether it has all these properties? Why embed it in something? You know, go into a larger setting and then find something. The reason is you cannot possibly hope to determine outside of the XMA category. I should not just outside of the XMA category, but in the setting that in which we're working, most of the time outside of the XMA category, you cannot determine whether or not you have an SRB measure by looking at a finite number of iterates. Okay. You need infinite. If you look at a finite number of iterates, things still look good. Maybe if you go further, it will not look so good. Okay. To determine whether something is an SRB measure requires that you know the system to infinite precision. So to prove a theorem is necessarily probabilistic. And one way to say this is to say if you have some one parameter family, then with positive measure set of parameters. Okay. That's necessary. This set, it probably has no interior. Right. In all the known situations, it has no interior. I don't know whether you can come up with something. Okay, so now I get to the last part of the talk, where I like to show you how these strange attractors come up, and one way to get them to come up, as I mentioned at the beginning, is to take a very simple dynamical system and kick it every so often. So here's one scenario. So phi t is any flow. Take an ODE, take any flow with a limit cycle. It's hyperbolic, attractive limit cycle. I'm going to kick it and let it relax and kick it and let it relax and hope to see a strange attractor. Now, to break, we all know that hyperbolic limit cycles are very, very robust. So to break this cycle, you're going to have to kick it enough, okay, to break it. So the theorem says that, and the theorem that we proved says that, I'm giving you an abstract version of the theorem right now. It says that there is, well, let me think of this forcing as an instantaneous kick. It doesn't really have to be instantaneous. It could really be a periodic forcing that's continuous in time. But what's important is the long relaxation in between. Okay. So let me just think about it in terms of kicks, which are just maps. You just map the neighborhood of the limit cycle to something, and that, so you map it, and then you let it flow back. You map it, and then you let it flow back. And the conclusion is that there is a positive measure set of kick intervals. So you let it, you wait time t before you kick. If you do that, then for a positive measure set of t's, the composite map kick and flowing for time t has a strange attractor. There is no reason whatsoever to use the kick interval t as your parameter, but I need a parameter because it's going to be a probabilistic statement. I have to invent a parameter, and this is just convenient. Okay. I could just as easily take another parameter of kicks, and then I would have my statement for every t. It doesn't really matter what I do here, but I gotta have a parameter, okay, because it's only true on positive probability on a positive measure set. Okay. So a couple of remarks is that if t here has to be taken very large, so you have to wait a long time before you can kick again. And this set of good kick intervals, t, is not just positive measure, but it's roughly periodic, and it's tuned into the period of the cycle. So from some point on, from say 1,000 on, you see some roughly periodic set with period, that of the cycle. And it is for real that I have to omit I can't possibly make prove a theorem that holds for all t, because there is a competing scenario, namely that of the transient chaos case, where you see horseshoes and things, and that really happens on some of the on the complement of the set of good parameters. Now, this idea of kicking a limit cycle is certainly not mine. It has been known for a very, very long time since the time of Vanderpol. So in 1927, Vanderpol already observed experimentally that if you periodically force a limit cycle, he didn't kick, he used cosine forcing, that something strange happens. It's no longer a limit cycle. And people tried to make this, at that time, of course, all the language that we have. It had to do with radio tubes. And they didn't know how to say any of these things at that time. And Cartwright and Littlewood and Levinson in the 40s made much more precise exactly what was found, namely that you have lots of different periodic orbits of different periods, so that can't possibly happen on a limit cycle. So I still remember that when I was a graduate student at Berkeley, we asked Steve to give a lecture one time on the history of dynamical systems. And this is one of the things that he said. He said that his horseshoe was, to some degree, inspired by Levinson's work on the Vanderpol attractor. So in 1980, Mark Levy proved the existence of horseshoes for this equation, but for a piecewise linear, referring to linear differential equation. He just cut this into three pieces and did it for some piecewise linear version of this, proving transient chaos. And more recently, a student of John Guggenheimer, Vadu Hajduk, did some computer assisted work to prove the existence of horseshoes in the original system. Now, in this system, horseshoes are really the particular way of driving. Transient chaos really is the dominant mode. Okay? Unlike the it's not the what I was talking about in the transparency before. Okay, so I want to give you a kind of movie kind of proof for how strange attractors are formed when limit cycles are kicked. Okay? So this is not how the proof goes, but it's kind of what's really happening. So my limit cycle is a circle that I'm only drawing a piece. It goes all the way back, and then you imagine it comes back like this. Okay, so everything is spinning is moving to the right. Okay, and let's, for definiteness, assume that my kick is to drive it up down so that it takes this line and then drives it into something like this by just kicking it up and down. Okay, so what I would do now is that I kick and then I let it, I relax and let the flow do the work. Now, as you relax the system, there are two kinds of restoring forces in general. Because it's an attractive limit cycle, there's contraction. So everything is going to try to come back to this line. So all these things are trying. Everything is moving to the right. I'm not going to talk about that. Okay, but everything is going to come back to this line, the contraction. More often than not, well, typically, there's also a shear, namely that one side, on one side of the cycle, something may be moving faster than another side. No, Charles says no. It's always... Huh? It's a hyperbolic cycle. There's still, one side still moves faster than another side. No? Doesn't contradict having a shear. They come back at the same time. What about this flow? Oh, you don't think this? You think this number is usually zero? This is not hyperbolic. I calculated this. The star stable foliation is like that. Yes. They are like that. So they come back. The green lines are invariant. Fixed. In this case. Because it's a kind of linear system. Okay. Doesn't contradict having a shear. That's because it only moves fast when you are far away from the cycle. When you come close, you don't move much anymore. That's the. There's no contradiction there, actually. Okay, so what's going to happen is that if the contraction is strong, and the shear is weak, so there's nothing is really tilted very much anymore. Don't forget that as you're not always going to be moving a lot faster because you come close to the cycle, right? So you're coming in at the same time. It's only when you are far away that you move so much farther, faster. Okay. So if the contraction is strong and the shear is weak, nothing much happens. It brings it right back down. Okay. But if the contraction is weak and the shear is strong, then what happens is that this part gets a bit ahead of the other part before you kick again. So what these pictures that I'm showing you is if I kick and then I let it flow for a while, what the picture would look like. Okay. That's what it would look like if I let it flow for a while. Now imagine that the cycle gets weaker and weaker, or the shear getting stronger and stronger, or both. Okay. So what happens is that it's going to be more and more exaggerated. In finite time, you will get ahead by so much. Okay. And if I make it even stronger still, it will get really way ahead of the other, of each other. Now, so this is what happens in one cycle of kick, relax. Now I'm going to repeat this cycle, and with your eyes, you can see that a horseshoe or something like that has been formed, but since there's no place to go, maybe there's a strange attractor, and so the geometric situation is now compatible with the setting that I was talking about. I will now apply the theorem, check the conditions, and say that the strange attractors are really there. Okay. You can do this with a computer very easily if the contraction doesn't have to be so weak before you see it. Okay. So there's a second situation that I want to mention. It's not. It's actually very much along the same lines, but it's a think about supercritical hop bifurcations. Okay. So a hop bifurcation is when you have a stationary point that's stable when mu is less than zero. As the parameter mu increases, it loses its stability. And it's spiraling in, and it goes from spiraling in to spiraling out. But since from far away it's still spiraling in, then a limit cycle results. Okay. So this is one of the two generic ways to lose for a stable equilibrium to lose its stability. Either there's a single eigenvalue that moves across like this, or a complex conjugate pair. So this is one of a very, very typical thing that happens. So our result says that under this condition, assume some genericity, namely the third order term should not be zero. Okay. Then there is an open set of kicks. It's the same. It's exactly the same result as before, but it's set here. So there's a positive measure set of kicks. There's an open set of kicks such that if you fix one of these kicks, then as mu passes zero, instead of, well, depending on whether you have your kick intervals are good, if your kick intervals are good, and that's good kick intervals constitute a positive measure set. Okay, so for positive, as mu gets past zero, instead of having a limit cycle coming out, you have a baby attractor coming out for a positive measure set of kick intervals in between. Okay, so and when I say strange attractors, again I mean that whole package of things that I mentioned earlier. So the very quickly, what happens is that so you look at the normal form. This can actually happen in any dimension, but let me just look at two dimensions. And if I write the normal form in these complex coordinates, and so look at the third order term. The first order term, we know exactly what happens. You have this pair of complex conjugate eigenvalues marching across the imaginary axis. Look at the third order term, and in particular, I look at the real and the imaginary part. Okay. I'm going to identify a factor which I call a twist factor. The twist factor is you only look at mu equal to zero, and you look at the imaginary part divided by the real part. Now, the imaginary part tells you how it's turning. The real part tells you how it's compressing, and this ratio turns out to be exactly the right thing. Okay. So what happens is that you do a kick. So there are many ways to kick it. So here's one way to do it is to do a radial kick. So you just disturb the attractor a little bit. Then if the twist factor times the amplitude of the kick, if it's bigger than something, which of course depends on how you kick it, then you have a strange tractor. Okay, so it has to twist enough. So again, let me show you a movie picture of why this is true. It's like this, that the suppose if I was to not kick it, okay, then what happens is this red guy, that limit cycle that comes out, would look like this. Suppose at some moment, mu, I freeze the picture, and I look. If I didn't kick it, it would look like this. Okay. If I kick it, then let's say I change the shape to this. It doesn't have to be that, as you will see. Okay. So where green is really the same thing before. Now, there's a twist here. And this twist says that things that are farther away move at a different speed than things that are close to the center. Okay. It's really just a polar coordinates version of the last picture that I showed you. So what happens is that these parts are farther away, and these parts are closer. So some parts move farther, some parts move closer. Okay. And you can have the computer draw this in no time if you just put in some arbitrary function. So as you can see, it doesn't matter what I do here. I don't have to do something very definitive about making what shape it is. I need some parts to be farther than other parts, compared to the way it originally is. It's exactly the same. It's exactly the same. Well, technically it's not, because it's very degenerate when u is equal to zero, but it's exactly the same phenomenon that I'm saying twice. Okay, so in the last two transparencies, I'd like to mention some applications or potential applications, and these are applications from the mathematics point of view. I don't mean to suggest real life applications, and it's also a little bit speculative. Okay. So the first application is to Hodgkin-Huxley. This is a well-known model of a single neuron. It's an equation that balances the charges across the membrane of the axon of the giant squid, I believe. And so it's known to be an ODE in four dimension, and for many parameters has a limit cycle. So here the kick is to inject a voltage. So you stick in an electrode and you stimulate it periodically, and that's the kick. And the numerically, it's been verified by Kevin Lin, who's a postdoc at Courant, that for a positive measure set of parameters, you have strange attractors of the type that I'm talking about. But of course, this is numerically, you can't quite prove some of these things. Because of the shape of the limit cycle, the dominant mode is actually transient chaos. In the parameters that he investigated, however, you do see 10-15% or so of pretty definitively positively epilepsy exponents everywhere. So that's one application. A second application is the brusselator. This is a simplified equation of chemical reaction invented by Brigochine and Lefebvre. And so this equation involves I think six different chemicals. One and two are there to help three and four react. X and Y are the concentrations of three and four, and they produce at the same time, the reaction produces three and four and five and six, which you remove immediately, something like that. Okay, and in this, so the concentrations of three and four are given by two equations like this, together with a diffusion term. So it actually puts us in the partial differential equation setting. But I didn't really get into this, but some of the Hopf bifurcation stuff will also work in infinite dimensions. So it's been Hopf bifurcations are known to happen in these equations. It's well known that for suitable parameters, a Hopf bifurcation happens, and the kicks here involves periodically dripping in one of the chemicals. So if you periodically drip in one of the chemicals, I claim that in principle, a strange attractor would appear if you drip it in with the right intervals in between. This actually has been noticed by Prigogine and Lefebvre. And there are many other situations where, since it involves, you know, limit cycles, half bifurcations like that, it happens all over the place. Right? So one of the places where people have noticed that if you use a if you stimulate the system with a pulse every so often is with electronic circuits. So people have noticed this long before, you know, any of this happened, that if you periodically send in something, that something happens. Okay. And so for in a recent paper by these two gentlemen, they made the connection to the, it seems to fit the setting exactly of the situation that we were looking at. Another situation that where periodic behavior occurs is in population dynamics. So it's also well known that if you have a situation with these competitive systems, you period cyclical behaviors are present quite often. Not limit cycles, but I think saddles with homoclinic connections. It's like, you know, there's a grass and there's a prairie dog and there's a, you know, something. Fox or whoever eats a prairie dog. So things go in a sort of a cyclical manner, and this is exactly the right setting to destabilize the system. And I don't actually know anything about this paper, but I was told that, and I don't think it's exactly about that either, but they have apparently shown, checked the conditions and our theorem in this setting. Okay. So finally, I want to mention something that where it seems like a very natural setting to test the hypothesis of our results, but for which we have not been able to do, is in fluids. Well, fluids, it's well known that fluids have half bifurcations. For example, the rotating pair of rotating cylinders in Kuat-Taylor, or shooting a stream and forcing it past a sphere. And if you increase the velocity, then at some moment a half bifurcation starts to happen. We have not been able to do anything with anything like this, because you can't get your hands on the half bifurcation. You can't prove that even really a half bifurcation happens, let alone to actually be able to compute the twist factor. The buccillator was easy. That's why it was done there. Okay. So maybe it's there, maybe it's not. I should mention that you should not think of the type of strange attractors that we're producing as having anything to do with turbulence. It's not. Okay. It's really in the low Reynolds number range when the fluid is just starting to destabilize a little bit, starting to wobble a little bit. The message is not that you can make this thing very turbulent, but that if you give it a little bump every so often, then chaos may develop slowly. The time scale on which chaos develops is the time scale of the bumps, which is quite large. So it's more like you take something that is starting to wobble, and intentionally or unintentionally, you bump it a little bit every so often, then you do have the capability of destabilizing the structure of it. Even though it happens at a relatively slow rate. So I finish with by making a connection to Ruel Tarkin's observation from 30 some years ago, when at that time the question was something that is turbulent, actually not so turbulent, half bifurcations actually. It's right. So Ruel and Tarkin constructed some examples to show that arbitrarily near a third order half bifurcation, not the one that I had, but a couple more, you can have secondary, tertiary half bifurcations, there exist strange attractors. So it was quite controversial at the time, and what they did was to, by hand, insert what is called a Plickin attractor into the system. So I want to say that maybe it can be done a little bit easier now by just giving it a bump every so often if the twist factor is big enough. Thank you.